Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices, is made possible in part by Allstate and the Searle Funds at the Chicago Community Trust.
Good evening y bienvenidos a Chicago Tonight Latino Voices. I'm Alex Hernandez of Univision Chicago Primera Hora, which airs every weekday morning at 5 and 6. Thank you for sharing part of your weekend with us. On the show tonight, the Remain in Mexico policy remains in place despite a recent Supreme Court ruling. We get reaction from local immigrant rights advocates.
Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices, is made possible in part by Allstate and the Searle Funds at the Chicago Community Trust.
Good evening y bienvenidos a Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices. I'm Alex Hernandez of Univision Chicago Primera Hora, which airs every weekday morning at 5 and 6. Thank you for sharing part of your weekend with us. On the show tonight, the Remain in Mexico policy remains in place despite a recent Supreme Court ruling. We get reaction from local immigrant rights advocates on this matter. The number of Latinos enrolling in college has dropped during the pandemic. A look at what higher learning institutions can do to recruit and retain Latino students. Another powerful mural on Chicago's Lower West Side. Meet the artist behind the Eagle Warrior that's soaring over 18th Street in Pilsen.
How do urban meteor chasers catch these elusive glowing grains of grit?
And Chicago astronomer Joe Guzman is back with advice on how you can spot next week's Perseid meteor shower. First off tonight, the Supreme Court has certified its ruling allowing the Biden administration to end the Migrant Protection Protocol's policy, better known as Remain in Mexico. The policy was a cornerstone of former President Donald Trump's border policy, forcing migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. to wait in Mexico for hearings. The Supreme Court decision, issued in June, overruled a lower court that forced the policy to be reinstated in December. Though President Biden previously tried to end the policy, there has been little comment so far on when his administration might officially follow through. Joining us now with more are Gladys Molina Alt, Executive Director of the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights, and Eleda Olea, Associate Director of Programs at Alianza Americas. And also joining us is Daisy Funes, Executive Director of Centro Romero. Thank you, ladies, for joining us today. And I want to start with you, Gladys. You've spent time on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. Can you give us a picture of what the situation is right now?
Yes, Alex, I spent time along the border in Mexico, both in January of 2020, when the Trump administration was implementing MPP, Remain in Mexico policy, as well as in November of 2021, when the Biden administration had to implement the what we call the MPP 2.0. And what I've seen on the ground is families, parents, who talked about having to make a difficult decision of whether they remain in Mexico waiting for their cases to be processed or make that difficult decision to have their kids cross the border by themselves while they remain in Mexico. So family unity, something that we've seen be an issue at stake on the ground. We've also heard folks who are in these MPP camps talk about the security issues that they face, the kidnapping that happens, the rapes that happen, the violations of human rights for them as migrants in Mexico that take place. We've heard stories of rape, stories of extortion, all kinds of abuses that happen on the ground. But we also hear how it is for people to be subjected to MVP on the ground, getting up early in the morning in the wee hours of dawn to get in line to be able to cross the river into Texas, right, to sit in front of a camera, to have a hearing before a judge where they don't even get that in-person hearing before an immigration judge. So that's what we've seen on the ground, and that's what is at stake for people while this policy remains in place.
I know it's very tough for them. Is Mexico okay with this? What do they say?
Well, I haven't spoken to Mexican mm-hmm. officials myself. All I know is that in my most recent visit, where I went to Reynosa, Matamoros, Tamaulipas did not want MVP camps in their city anymore. So when I went in November of last year, everybody was in the plaza, in the encampment there in Reynosa, because Matamoros said they don't want to cooperate with this policy anymore. So I didn't get a chance to speak to any government official myself.
Thank you, Gladys. Elena, why do you believe Title 42 is an important piece of this discussion?
Well, it's important because MPP existed before Title 42, and then with the pandemic, the Trump administration enacted Title 42 with the excuse that the border needed to be closed for public health reasons. So we need to understand the interaction between these two policies, because even if there is an end to MPP, Title 42 continues to be operating in the southern border. And most of the individuals that are trying to seek asylum are being rejected, expelled, and returned to Mexico. So when we look at the numbers, there's more than 2 million people impacted by Title 42, and the number of people impacted by MPP, even though large, is less than around 80 or 90,000 persons. So we have to understand those two policies and how they have been put in place, one temporarily, one with the idea that they could seek asylum, but Title 42 simply prevents anyone from seeking asylum.
Daisy, how is the Remain in Mexico policy currently affecting the lives of the immigrants that you work with?
Yeah, it is very difficult, because even though you said it's the south of the border of the United States, we still see the consequences of people that had their families. So taking families apart, breaking families, that's the hardest part, because we're talking about, I mean, one of the biggest groups that started to come, it was women and children. That's why we see a lot of the children in cages than before in the Trump administration. And even though this administration right now said, well, we don't have them in cages, we have in a special space, they're still in jail. They're still in protection by the CBP, right? So what we see is families waiting to receive their families here. There is an immigration system that is broken. It needs to be fixed. It needs to be in a humane way. Like for example, when we look at what happened to Ukrainian, right? So the treatment they have received as immigrants and refugees coming to this country had very, very different approach for the mm-hmm. administration than the ones that come from the south of the border. It has to do with the policies. It has to do how United States and the policymaker here
Something
look at
us. Has to change, definitely. And going back with you, Gladys, what do people not know about the immigration picture?
I think what people don't know about the immigration picture, it's tricky to understand sometimes, is how what Elena was getting at is how the Title 42 and Remain in Mexico policies interact with each other. So for those in Remain in Mexico, subject to the Remain in Mexico policy, those are folks that even get the chance to come to the border and present themselves to seek asylum, and then are sent back to Mexico to wait out that process of applying for asylum. Whereas Title 42 doesn't even allow somebody to show up to immigration authorities on the U.S. side uh-huh. and even make that application. So both of those policies have to be brought to an end. And
Definitely.
Now the Supreme Court has certified that decision, we call on the Biden administration to take that action. Each minute that the administration does not decide to end MPP, it's people's lives at risk in Mexico.
Elena, what would you like to see the Biden administration do at this point? And I just want to remind you, we're very short on time at this point.
Well, I think it's not only putting an end to MPP and to Title 42, but it's also establishing a new narrative, a narrative that counteracts to the stories and the depiction of migrants and asylum seekers as an invasion, as a threat to the United States. We have to uplift the valuable contributions that we make to the United States. We have to uplift the importance of immigrant families in the fabric of the U.S. society. And that's that shift, that narrative shift, where we need the leadership of the Biden administration.
Daisy, how would you characterize how the American people feel about the immigration right now? We have less than a minute.
I think that the people, our regular people, does not understand the policies. So it's a great work that we need to do in terms of education, not only for the people that have been living for generations, people that are living here, but also to the immigrants that are being here for a generation. Mm-hmm. So the idea is to create a fabric where everybody feel like we are a contributor to this country. We all pay taxes. We all deserve the same rights. I think we have to go back to our rights as an immigrants and refugees in this country, but also to those ones that are arriving from other countries, making sure they understand what is for them here.
Definitely. Well, I want to thank all three of you for joining us today. Definitely a very big topic. We could spend a whole hour talking about this. Thank you to Gladys Molina Alt, Elena Olea, and Daisy Funes.
Thank you.
Up next, what's behind declining Latino college enrollment? Stay with us. For the three decades leading up to 2020, the rate of Latinos enrolling in college was steadily rising. But when COVID pandemic began, those numbers took an immediate hit. A report by the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center shows a 5.4% drop in the headcount of Latino undergraduates in fall of 2020. And for the first time in 20 years, the number of Hispanic-serving institutions of higher education in the U.S. dropped from 569 in 2020 to 559 in 2021. Joining us now with more on what's behind the numbers and how colleges can reverse that decline are Isaura Pulido, professor of educational inquiry and curriculum studies at Northeastern Illinois University, Emila Lavandera, director of research at the National Organization Excelencia in Education, and Ines Sahagún Baena, director of National Lewis University's Centro de Excelencia. I want to welcome all of you to the show. Thank you for being here. And I want to start with you, Emily. What are the Latino enrollment trends looking like nationwide? Is this problem concentrated only in certain areas?
Sure. Thank you, Alex. Well, you know, we are seeing that the Latino student, you know, enrolled in college, that population was actually growing over the years. But once the pandemic hit, we have seen a decline in college enrollment for Latino students. We have seen that across other student groups, but at Excelencia, our focus is, you know, accelerating Latino student success. And so as part of the research team, that's the group we focus on. We put a Latino lens on all of our research.
Right. Ines, the National Lewis University is a Hispanic-serving institution. Can you explain what that designation means, and have you been seeing enrollment declines also in your institution?
Certainly. Thank you for that question. So as a Hispanic-serving institution, that is a federal designation given to higher education institutions that have at least 25% of their full-time undergraduate students identifying as Latinx and who are low-income. So National Lewis University and other universities here in Illinois receive the designation, and there's a federal support as well. Now, I do want to mention that Centro de Excelencia report that came out, and they are the leading voice these HSIs and the student populations there did indicate that in certain states, their decline was not experienced. So in Illinois, we do not see that decline. National Louis University, other universities have experienced continuous growth. The pandemic affected that. There's been a slow growth, but there is continued growth in Illinois.
Okay. Isaura, what are you hearing from students about their experiences as students during COVID?
It's hard. It's really hard for them. They are having to take up responsibilities at home, things like childcare, things like if they have younger siblings that were attending school during remote learning, they sometimes would have to supervise siblings, which meant that then they couldn't be in class. And now that we've returned to on-campus classes, some students still have some of that responsibility, which makes it harder for them to be in school.
Right. Going back with you, Emily, Latino College enrollment was trending up prior to COVID. What does this decline tell us about the support systems Latino students have while enrolled in school?
Sure. And certainly we can think about support systems in the sense of community and family and support systems in terms of what institutions can do. So in terms of the institutional lens, and at Excelencia, we work a lot with institutions in our networks like those represented here today. We can think about, you know, institutions understanding their student population and considering how they're retaining their students. What support services are they supplying? You know, are they supporting their students financially during this time? Because we're seeing that, you know, the loss of income, certainly financial disruptions. Latino students present a post-traditional student profile, as we say at Excelencia, you know, where they might be first gen or working while enrolled, you know, to really be pragmatic about how they're making college affordable for them.
Definitely. Ines, what do you think is so unique about the Latino student populations?
Well, it's exactly what we were talking about. They are not the typical commuter student that goes away, who stays at a college and is there to study primarily. These are students who commute to school, have familial obligations. They want to be with the communities. They want to be involved with the communities. They work and they take care of the communities. So we need to support them in that lens, as we're talking about here.
Definitely. Going back with you, Isaura, why do you think higher ed institutions should care about bringing in and retaining Latino students?
Because this is the demographic with the largest growth across the country. And I think that if we are thinking about the future of higher ed and even the future of the U.S., you know, with the numbers that we have currently, our future is really going to be determined by the future of Latinos.
Good point. Ines, what can institutions be doing to better support Latino students?
Well, the institutions, specifically the Hispanic serving institutions, have pivoted to make sure that they listen and learn from the students and their families. They're going back to those initiatives and strategies that proved effective, that were really the motivation behind that growth that Isaura has mentioned. So they're returning to that. They are, in fact, outreach to their students and their families in their preferred language and in their communities. They're expanding their support systems on campus to make sure that they continue to address the digital divide, help with their supports in basic needs, such as mental health well-being, and food insecurity is another issue, and addressing tuition costs. So institutions in general need to continue to focus on those areas of need.
Emily, do you think this will be a short-term lift dip or a long-term problem?
We certainly do look at projected data through the rest of this decade. So we are seeing from those projections that the Latino student population will continue to grow. So there is definitely a positive there and an opportunity to really think about how we're serving intentionally this student group, how we're serving our Latino students, accelerating their success, and even thinking beyond college and into a post-completion, what does that look like?
Definitely. Isaura, we have about a minute left, but I do want to ask, what advice do you have for students who might be struggling now and considering even dropping out?
I would tell them to talk to someone at their institution, a trusted faculty member, staff member, to tell them the kind of issues that they're having, because sometimes students are not aware of the different options and assistance that may be available and might be able to keep them in school.
I want to thank all of you for joining us today, Isaura Pulido, Ines Agun Baena, and Emily Lavandera. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gracias, thank you.
Up next, details on a mural soaring over 18th Street. Stay with us.
Don't ever miss Chicago Tonight. Subscribe to our podcast. Get a daily download of our show delivered to your desktop or mobile device. Go to WTTW.com/Chicago Tonight Podcast and subscribe.
The Pilsen neighborhood is home to some of Chicago's most vibrant murals. So adding to that culture is a tall order for any artist. Muralist Mauricio Ramirez answered that call with his rendering of a three-story tall Aztec Eagle Warrior soaring above 18th Street. Ramirez says he hopes the noble figure, which he completed in 2021, inspires pride in all who see it.
Public art should always be loud and proud. It should be bold. It should really enhance people's lives that live within the community. What up? My name is Mauricio Ramirez, and today we're at the Pilsen Warrior mural. And when I was approaching this, I wanted to create a piece of work that spoke to the community directly by creating a homage to the Aztec Eagle Warrior muralist in the past, but also kind of create some sort of Aztec hero. I ultimately wanted to show an evolution of how young boys kind of look up to their older, you know, siblings or cousins, and those siblings kind of look to their older uncles or dads. The mural's generational. You have 5-6-year-old kid kind of looking up to maybe a bigger teenager, middle-aged male figure. And then that figure is kind of looking up to the final form, right? The hero form. We invited the entire community of Chicago to come out and actually help physically paint parts of the mural. So these lower triangles that you see right here behind me, community members came out and actually painted it. And I think that's important because it ultimately shares ownership of the mural. It's not just me kind of going in, but you know, it's kind of a collaborative effort. Public art has a lot of functions. It could be political, it could be controversial, it could be purely aesthetic, it could be communicative, it could be, you know, storytelling, or it could just be for the sake of art. And I think Pilsen has all those different types of things that make public art work. Pilsen's changing, and there's a lot of weird things that are happening. Gentrification's one, and I feel like for every like vape shop that opens up in like a community, I feel like there should be some sort of cultural historical piece to kind of counteract that. You can't come here to this specific part of town and create something that's very mediocre. There's a lot of talent here. If you have the opportunity and the privilege to create something this large, I think you should be creating some of the best work you possibly can. That's what makes this city so beautiful. I just feel honored to be part of that movement.
You can actually see the Pilsen Warrior for yourself on 18th Street, just east of Ashland Avenue. And well, one of summer's most spectacular shows comes courtesy of a comet. Every August, the Perseid meteor shower puts on a fiery display in the night sky. And while this year, that display might be a little harder to see than in past years, Chicago astronomer Joe Guzman says it's still worth getting out there and looking up.
Hi, sky lovers. I'm Joe Guzman, the Chicago astronomer, back again for another guide as we share and enjoy our urban skies together. This time, we're talking about space debris, or better known as meteor showers. At this time of the year, every August, our planet plows through a belt of space grains, leftover debris vented from a comet named Swift Tuttle. These gritty space grains ionize in our upper atmosphere about 60 miles high, traveling at 37 miles per second and reaching an incredible 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. At this temp, electrons are stripped away from their nuclei and glow as they briefly streak across the sky, bringing a lot of smiles and oohs and ahs. This major August celestial show, commonly known as the Perseid meteor shower, is a perennial favorite of all sky lovers. And this year's peak will be on Thursday, August 11th, until Saturday, August 13th. But you can observe these meteors a good week before and after this peak. But unlike last year, a near full moon will glare bright in our skies for the main show, limiting the shower to only the brighter grains for the urban sky watcher. The best time to catch meteors is after 12 a.m. midnight. But meteors are unpredictable, and they may appear soon after twilight and anywhere in the sky. And some say this year's peak activity will occur at 9 p.m. Great for the younger astronomer with an early bedtime. And the question many ask is, well, can you observe them from the city? Sure you can. The brighter ones will overcome the urban light pollution quite easily. And all you need are your eyes, a comfy spot away from direct glare. No telescopes or binoculars are required, but a darker environment is preferred for the fainter meteors. How many can you expect to catch under urban skies in a near full moon this year? About 3 to 5 per hour is quite reasonable. So, look up and spot ionizing comet grains glowing high above our urban skies. You can follow our Chicago Astronomer events and activities across the city on all social media platforms. And remember, the skies are free, and so are the views. I'm Joe Guzman, the Chicago Astronomer.
Well, like you just heard, the Chicago Astronomer hosts free sky gazing events year-round. You can follow him on social media for more information. We have details on that also on our website. And before we go, a longtime advocate for equity in the arts has died. The Chicago Latino Theater Alliance announced the death this week of its co-founder and executive director, Mirna Salazar. Salazar was a native of Puerto Rico and raised in Chicago, where she was a longtime advocate for Latino artists and their representation on Chicago stages. She was 75 years old. Well, that's going to be our show for this weekend. Be sure to check out our website, WTTW.com/news, for the very latest from WTTW News. While you're there, make sure you read about our story on COVID-19 booster shots. And if you need some ideas on what to do this weekend, check out our summer festival guide, which is also on our website. If you're watching us on Saturday night, know that you can also catch Latino Voices and Black Voices on Sundays beginning at 10 p.m. Don't forget also to tune in to Primera Hora on Univision Chicago every weekday morning at 5 and 6. And we leave you tonight with Renacer Bolivia's dance troupe as they prepare to perform at the Renacer Bolivia Summer Festival. The festival is taking place Sunday, August 7th in Schuyler Woods. More information on that on our website as well. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight Latino Voices, I'm Alex Hernandez. Thank you for sharing part of your weekend with us. Buenas noches.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm, and proud sponsor of programming that offers advice and strategies to enhance the physical and mental well-being of fellow legal practitioners in Illinois.